We spend the first three lectures working hard to produce a generating function of part Taylor amplitudes. And this is a generating function that contains all amplitudes with what we call k equals to 2, negative helicity gluons. Of course, we're working with m particles, and that means that m minus k of them had positive helicity. Then yesterday, we showed the reason we spend so much time working on part Taylor amplitudes, because the payoff was that we were able to boost that formula into a formula that is now known as the Witten RSV formula, which generalizes part Taylor to any value of k from 2 to m minus 2. Again, k is the number of negative helicity particles, and m minus k is the number of positive helicity. Very good. And what was the trick, or the observation, was that we could think about the part Taylor amplitude as a theory, or as an object that is telling us a story about maps from a Riemann sphere whose coordinates we're calling sigma to another Riemann sphere whose coordinates can be called lambda of alpha. And the way to generalize the story in the Witten RSV formulation was to say that the simple degree one maps that we had for part Taylor amplitudes had to be generalized and allowed to be degree D maps. And D ended up being related to K by K minus 1. OK, that's all very good. But now imagine that somebody decided that they didn't like lambdas. So from the very beginning, you could have asked, well, why do we have to discriminate positive helicity particles? Who said that negative helicity particles were more important? Well, we could start today the lecture again and start everything by switching pluses and minuses. Of course, it would take us, again, four lectures, but we don't have to do it, right? So what do you think we have to do to get the same formulas, but now by switching positive and negative helicity particles? Is there a trick that we can use to do that? What do we have to switch? Well, if you want to get a clue, look at your three particle amplitudes in your notes. Look at this amplitude and look at this amplitude. What do you have to do to go from here to here? That's it. You just switch lambda, lambda, tilde, and then you're done. So we could have done the generating function for part Taylor amplitudes conjugated, where now what's special is to be positive helicity, because only two of them will be positive helicity, and the rest will have negative helicity. And all we had to do was to switch lambdas and lambda tildes. OK, if we want to now have equality between negative and positive helicity particles, we better introduce some notation for those. So let's call k tilde the number of plus helicity particles. and k, the number of negative Felicity particles. Now they don't really look special. And it's obvious that all we have to do is to switch lambdas and lambda tildes everywhere. And if we had done that, the same story would have landed us on a story of maps of degree what? Should be completely obvious now what the degree has to be. D tilde, of course, right? Because we're supposed to put tildes everywhere where there are no tildes. Into a space that now is parameterized by what? By lambda tilde of alpha dot of sigma. And it's given by a parametrization of this form. But d tilde is related to k tilde using what formula? Exactly the same formula, but now with k tilde. All right. Now that you're given that, you have in front of you a map that sends you from sigma and produces some lambda. Here, one that sends you from sigma and produces a lambda tilde. Every time you have a lambda and a lambda tilde, don't they want to be together to produce what kind of object? If you put a lambda with a lambda tilde together, what do you produce? Have you ever seen an object like this before? Does it transform in any interesting representation of the Lorentz group? A vector, right? We can go from that object producing an object that has a vector index. That's how we discovered these things in the first place. We started with a vector, and we ended up with something like this. So what this thing is telling us is that it's possible we have at our disposal a map from this space to where? This is the null con in momentum space. What's the map? You take sigma, any point here, and you send it here to this null vector. Constructed from exactly what you have there, from this guy and that guy. What's the degree of the new map? Well, the degree is just the sum of the degrees of the two factors, right? We're counting these things as polynomials. So this one has degree d. This one has degree d tilde, and we're adding them up. What do we get? Look on the board. Well, yes, you're going to say it's k plus k tilde minus 2. No, no, but in terms of n, so let's go to the definition of k tilde there. What do we have? OK, so let's do it. K plus k tilde minus 2, but k tilde is m minus k. So this is k independent. Isn't that nice? So no matter what you're doing, for any value of k, the object is defining for you a map from the sphere to the null con of degree m minus 2. Well, that looks interesting. Let's see if we can do something with that. Now we have to remember how to connect this to the external data. Well, we don't have to invent anything. We have to look at how we did it for the Witten RSV formula from the beginning. So on the left-hand side of the top blackboard, we know that the way to connect to external data, so somebody gives you a set of lambdas, and you connect them to the maps in this way. Look at the definition of the map over there, and look at your notes. You will see that that's exactly what we had yesterday. Now we can repeat the same thing for the tilde version, the one that we could have done from the beginning of the lectures, but we didn't. We ended up favoring the lambdas. But we could have done exactly the same thing for the lambda tildes. And what are we going to introduce here? T tilde. OK, that's the way we have connected the data. Now, can we use this to figure out how to connect the data to this map of degree m minus 2? Well, yes, we would say that this implies is that the momentum k, which happens to be the product of the lambdas and lambda tildes, has to be equal to the product of these two things. So it's Ta times Ta tilde, lambda of sigma, alpha, lambda tilde, alpha dot, sigma. Evaluated, sorry, I forgot to put here, these guys are evaluated at the value of sigma A that corresponds to the particle A, and the same thing here. So we're supposed to do the same evaluation here. So this is all looking very good, except that now we have these products of t's, and we don't know how to find them in a nice way. We still have to solve all the problem of Witten RSV for this case, and all the problem for Witten RSV in this case. And once we find the solution, we can plug it into here. Wouldn't it be nice if we found a way to find the connection between these maps and this external data so that we didn't have to compute what these guys were from the original problems? Well, the key is to look at momentum conservation. Well, momentum conservation tells us that the sum over Ka, alpha, alpha dot, from 1 to n has to be 0. So we can plug that relation there. And this must be true. Now, what I want to do is to use the form of the maps. Just look at the definition here and there. Let's plug it into that relation and see what we learn. So using what this is, we can write this as a sum over the components of this map and a sum over the components of this map. Yesterday, we called the components of this map the index m that went from 0 to d. Now I'm going to sum over the components of this map. Not surprised here. M tilde to d tilde. I'm going to collect those components here. So I get m alpha and rho m tilde tilde alpha dot. And I'm going to put here everything else that I have in this sum. So I'm switching the sums over m tilde and a, passing those sums to the end or to the beginning, and then keeping the sum over a here. And I get ta times ta tilde times sigma a m plus m tilde. Why am I doing that? It looks complicated. Well, the reason is the following. If I want momentum conservation to be true for any maps, I better require that this thing is equal to 0 for any m plus m values, which can take values from where? So m plus m tilde take values in these sums. So the independent possibilities are, we can start from zero, as zero, zero. So this could start from zero. It cannot be negative, so it can start from zero. I can have zero and one, two, and what's the maximal value that I can have? D plus D tilde, which is, look at the other board. Is what?
N minus two.
N minus two, exactly. So how many equations do I have? I have N minus one equations to find these guys in terms of the sigmas. And I have N variables. So I can solve this and still be left with one global rescaling, which I can use to set whatever that variable that is left to one. What's the solution? So we want to use those equations. So we have, this implies that we have N minus one equations to solve for these variables. Let me call them, I don't know, we can call them TA, TA times TA tilde, in terms of sigmas. Well, if you have never seen equations like that, then you do what we all do. We start with n equals to 3, n equals to 4, n equals to 5. You put it in Mathematica, you solve it, until you start to see a pattern emerging for the solution of these guys. And what you find is that these TAs, which are the product of the two T's, of the two little T's, have a nice simple structure. They end up being 1 over the product from B1 to N. Of course, we have to remove B equals to A, B different from A, of the differences of sigmas. So we found a very simple solution for our maps. Now we can go back here and say, well, so we have our equivalent maps, but let's call them new maps. New formulation of the maps, where we go from here to of course, what I'm doing here is completely equivalent to what we had before. All I'm doing is to say, well, since we don't have to split things into lambdas and lambda tildes anymore, because we don't have anything that depends on k, because now we can reformulate everything in a k-independent way, maybe we could just define straightforwardly maps from sigma to the null con that have degree n minus 2. So this would be the most general one. And how do we connect it to the data? Using what? Well, we now say that the momentum Ka mu has to be connected to our maps through the following relation. We use P mu of sigma A divided by, so we now use what this thing was from the solution we found. So now we have a formula that connects the data to the space of maps from sigma to the null con of degree n minus 2. But now this formula has something remarkable in it. Does it depend on the dimensionality of spacetime? Are we in four dimensions? Is there anything on this board that will remind you that you are in four dimensions? Not on that one, this one. Just on this. So this seems to be valid for all dimensions. After all, we have a vector index. And that vector index can go from 0, 1 to m minus to d minus 1. So this is the part of the lecture where you were supposed to say, wow. Okay, so let's look at momentum conservation again, but now from this point of view, I'm using this mass. So what is momentum conservation? We wrote it over there. We just have to ask the sum over all these things. Let's put the index down so that it doesn't mix with the vector index. This has to be equal to 0. And that means that we have to require that sum. To be 0. And if we want this to be true for every one of the components of the map Pn, we need so let me write it more explicitly. We can pull out the component m from 0 to m minus 2 of Pm, so Pm mu. And here what we have is the sum over sigma a to the m and this product. So I'm just rewriting what we had over there, but you will see why I'm doing it again. The reason is that it looks slightly nicer written in this form, and you might recognize it even. So we are requiring this thing to be 0 for all m from 0 to m minus 2. Have you ever seen something that looks like that? Maybe you have to look back, not during these courses, during the side program. You have to look at your undergraduates. And you don't have to look at the physics courses. You have to be mathematical methods. So objects like this appear when you do Lagrange interpolation. So when you were doing numerical methods and things like that, you found this thing. So of course, I didn't pay attention with it. but it turns out that this is related to that. So luckily, this is pretty standard. And it turns out that there is a nice way of showing that this is actually 0. So this is supposed to be an identity. But how do you prove it? So let's actually prove it. So once again, this is not a condition. It is an identity. Remember, that's how we found the value of t times t tilde. We solved that system by putting it in mathematics and solving it for many, many values until we could recognize the pattern. But if we had known or remembered about Lagrange polynomials and interpolation, we could have found a nice proof for this. And the proof you have found, we have in the following. You could say that this guy in the denominator is nothing but, or is related to a polynomial in a variable z that contains everyone. But somehow here, you're only missing one at a time. Okay. And the one that you're missing is the one that appears in the numerator. So what if we induce the value of the one that we want by introducing an integration, a complex variable integration, that circles the pole at sigma a, and that's the value we want. Actually, I could have used b here. And here, we put z to the m. Do you agree that this object is exactly equal to the first term here, or to the term, the eighth term? This object here is nothing but sigma a to the m, the product of sigma a minus sigma b, with b different from a. Now we can sum over this. Tactical error here. Now we could sum over a here from 1 to n and get the sum we're interested in. But now this is something on the complex plane. It has a bunch of poles. We're circling all the poles. We can use the residue theorem to combine all these contours. So we had some poles. We have this integration. Now we use the residue theorem and say, well, instead of doing this integration, we're going to do this integration. And now take this contour to infinity. But this integral at infinity behaves like what? So this whole thing is equal to the integral of the same object, but now on a contour around infinity. Well, this doesn't look like infinity. So we just have to analyze the behavior of this polynomial, of this rational function at infinity. So this goes like z to the m, and the denominator goes like z to the n. So the whole thing goes like z to the n, 1 over z to the m minus m. And this object is 0 when you integrate around infinity, if and only if m minus m is greater or equal than 2. But that's exactly the condition we have. We have exactly no room to spare. If we had gone even 1 degree higher, this wouldn't have been satisfied. So since when you get to this point, you say, well, I think I'm doing something right, right? You say, okay, this is just right. So it's working perfectly. That's very nice. Okay. So why are we doing all this? Remember, one of the questions yesterday was whether the whole construction of Witten RSV using these rational maps was something that was a miraculous property of n equals 4 super Jahn Mills in 4 dimensions. The most supersymmetric theory that you can have in 4 dimensions is a theory that has tons of important miraculous properties like integrability is dual to string theory on type 2B, string theory on ADS cross S5. So the fact that the formula existed could have been just one more check mark in the list of remarkable properties. So that would have been annoying, perhaps. So we are searching for a way of breaking away from n equals 4 super Jahn Mills. And it seems that we're on the right track because we have something that connects now to all possible dimensions. Now, I don't know how much you know about supersymmetry, but at the very least, you know that the number of bosonic degrees of freedom has to match the number of fermionic degrees of freedom. And you also probably know that the dimension of the spinor representation in a given space-time grows very, very fast with the number of dimensions, right? It goes roughly like 2 to the d. So if you're in 100 dimensions, what would be the number of degrees of freedom in the smallest possible representation that you can have? It would be incredibly big, right? 2 to the 100, perhaps, or 2 to the 50, depending on how you count if you impose the Weyl condition. But still, it doesn't help you. So no supersymmetries, no supersymmetric field theories exist beyond 11 dimensions. So 11 dimensions is the last one where you can do the nice matching of degrees of freedom. But now we have a formula that we can evaluate in 20 dimensions. So whatever we get with these formulas has to be something that doesn't rely on the existence of supersymmetry. So that sounds good and scary at the same time. Maybe we won't get anywhere, right? All right, so let's continue. So this was just a small break from there. So what do we want to do now? Is that the timer that says that it's half an hour? That's very good. Okay. Let's look at this object here. But not quite at that object, but let's put it all together with all the components of the map. So we found this interesting thing. And momentum conservation was the statement that this thing is equal to zero. So you agree? We were looking just at a particular component of this polynomial, but momentum conservation was really the statement about the whole polynomial. Now we can look at this object and say, well, isn't that an interesting object? It looks like a rational function that maps z again into the null con. But by now, from the BCFW lecture, every time you have a function of z, you could start asking questions about that function. So what would be the first question you would ask? What do you think? You have a function of z, so what would you ask? What are the poles of this guy, right? Well, the answer here is that it only has simple poles. And where are they located? At all the locations of the sigma a's. What's the second question that you would ask? Yeah, what are the residues? And what's the answer here? What happens if you compute? Look here. Look at the definition. Or even better, look up there. You get Ka. And the third question. What was the third question we asked? Does it vanish at infinity? And what's the answer? Yes, we made sure that it did. And once you have the three questions answered, remember that we constructed what the function was. How did we write it down? We said, well, it was a sum over all the residues, over all the poles. And what we did was to put in the numerator of this formula the residues. And it vanishes at infinity. That means that there is no polynomial part that we have to write down here. There is no constant term. This is the answer. OK. So we got two different ways of writing the same object. We can write it like this, or we can write it like this. We can either start with this object and say that this object maps us to the null con and impose that its residues are connected to the external data. Or we can start with this formula, which has this property already manifest, but is missing a property that is important for this whole connection to be true. What's the property that is missing? Now we have to impose that object actually is a map to the null count. And how do we do it? Well, we have to impose that the norm of this object happens to be zero for all values of z. If we had constructed the object starting from a momentum vector, p mu, that was already a null vector, then this property would have been satisfied. But at this point, this object could have been constructed just by requiring these conditions. And then asking for this would be a way of connecting or determining the sigmas, the values of the sigmas in terms of the kinematic data. And that's what we're going to do now. So let's write this explicitly. Well, we take the two copies of this vector and hit them together, and we're going to get something that looks like this. We're going to get a double sum because each term has a sum. So we're going to get a double sum that goes from 1 to n each of the values. But I'm just going to have half of the sum because each of the terms look the same and put a factor of 2 instead. And we get 2 times dot ka dot kb divided by z minus sigma a, z minus sigma b. And this thing has to be equal to 0. This thing here, we're dealing with null vectors, so it's ka plus kb squared. And this is usually denoted as SAB. It's a Mandelstam variable. Now we're almost done, because that condition tells us the possible values of sigmas once you give me the kinematic data in terms of Mandelstam invariants. So given SABs, we have to find sigmas such that that condition is satisfied. But how do we impose that condition? Well, you see, this is a rational function of z. If this is equal to 0, it must mean that every possible residue of this object is also equal to 0, right? So this guy seems to have poles at the locations where z is equal to sigma a or z is equal to sigma b. It only has simple poles because of this condition. So all we have to do is to require that the residue of this thing at, say, sigma a is equal to 0. It must be a property of any formula whose sum is equal to 0. Okay. So how do we do it? We impose that the residue at z equals to sigma a vanishes. Well, what's the residue? We have to compute the integral of that whole object at z equals to sigma a. And the answer that you find is that for every value of b, there is one term that contributes and we have to impose that this is all true for all values of a from 1 to n. So these are equations that connect the space of kinematic invariants to the space of points on the Riemann sphere. And these are called, or these are known now as the scattering equations. And these were introduced, we introduced them in 2013. So there is a nice story here. Ellis Yuan was a Psi student at the time. And Song was a postdoc here at PI and is now sitting here in the audience. So at the time, he was also at PI. So we stumbled across these equations. And we said, well, they seem to be the key that connects everything between the space of points on the sphere and the space of kinematic invariants. Moreover, if you trace our steps back, this is the engine that makes Witten RSV work. How many solutions would you find if you're given the S's and you're supposed to find the sigmas? So you're supposed to solve these equations. Once again, you can put them in Mathematica and do it for n equals 3, n equals 4, n equals 5, and you can try to see a pattern. But I told you the answer yesterday. How many solutions were there in total? This is a way of unifying all the sectors with k, the negative helicity particles. We did it for k equals to 2, k equals 3, k equals 4. And I told you yesterday that we had the Eulerian numbers. But if you sum them up from k equals to 2 to m minus 2, we found, well, if you search in Wikipedia, the answer was that the total number of solutions was m minus 3 factorial. Okay? So, in 2013, we found the equations and we made a conjecture or a hope. Let's make it better. We stated a hope. The hope was that perhaps these equations would serve as the engine not only of Witten RSV, but also for any theory of massless particles. So what do I mean by this long sentence? What I mean is that we conjecture that the scattering amplitude for m particles of any theory of massless particles could be written as, in any number of dimensions, as something that preserves momentum conservation with the volume of SL2C, an integral over all the possibilities of having points on a sphere subject to these equations that we have over there. Times some integrand that will depend on the theory that could possibly have dependence on momentum, polarization vectors, and the sigmas, but only a polynomial dependence. The conjecture was then basically that all the pole structure, all the singularity structure of any scattering amplitude at tree level for massless particles would be produced by this integral. You didn't have to put it in by hand, so this object would take care of that, and there would be some integrand that takes care of all the other details in the theory. So what could this integrals be? These integrands. So let's try to think about Young Mills. Well, we can get inspiration from Witten RSV. In Witten RSV, we found an object that looks like this. Our famous Port-Taylor formula. And then, if you remember, we not only had this, but we also had something that had all the supersymmetries and all these different kinds of objects in addition to just this simple factor. So we need something here. And we shouldn't call I because we already have an I, so or we have to do something to this. So what can we do? Well, one possibility would be to say that this total integrand splits into a left integrand, and how about this? And a right integrand. So that solves the problem of the notation. So what do we want for this right integrand? What does it have to do? Let's see, this one is slightly better in terms of a blackboard. So let me erase this. Just that one is very hard to get the chalk on the board. All right. So what do we want? So at the time we knew this piece. And now the conjecture was that you could find this thing. So the conjecture is there exists a right integrand such that this formula will give rise to Young Mills, to the scattering amplitudes of Young Mills for any number of particles in any number of dimensions. So what do we want out of this thing? Again, it's something that depends on these functions. So we are supposed to get something that is gauge invariant. In four dimensions, we didn't have to worry about that. Magically, all the reference spinors disappear. There is nothing there. In your tutorial, you saw how the reference spinors completely drop out. So we didn't have to worry about gauge invariant. But here, we don't have spinors. So we have to require that for every A, we get the same answer if we replace this by this. But this looks like a miracle, because we are supposed to require that by a miraculous cancellation of n minus 3 factorial terms. That seems almost impossible, unless it happens for every one of them in a trivial way. So that was the main clue. So we want gauge invariance for each solution to these scattering equations. So something that is trivial, it better be something that is a consequence of linear algebra or something very, very, very simple. So it's hard to motivate what the answer looks like or how to get the answer. So I'm just going to tell you what the answer is and convince you that it's actually trivial that this property holds. So the idea is to write down a matrix. Again, if you want to make something trivial, linear algebra is your choice. So we're going to construct a 2m by 2m matrix such that the rows are labeled by momenta from 1 to n. And in the second half, we're going to have polarization vector in the hope that when I replace one of these guys by the corresponding momentum, I get a linear dependence and I get zero if I'm computing something like a determinant. So that's the hope. And the same thing will happen here. So let me write down this column. So here, every time I see an index here and an index here, I write the first index k2.k1, and I divide by the difference of the sigmas. So kn.k1, sigma m minus sigma 1. And here I have epsilon1.k1. That is 0, but it's also divided by 0. So I'm not quite sure what to write there. So I'm going to write epsilon2.k1. Sigma 2 minus sigma 1. epsilon n dot k1 sigma m minus sigma 1. And I can keep this pattern going. Here, this is epsilon 1 with epsilon 1. So it's also divided by sigma 1 minus sigma 1. But this one better be 0. Just as this one was 0, just by definition. Now I can do the same thing all over the place and populate this matrix. But let me only do it here as well. So I'm going to have k1 with this guy, again, my dilemma, what to do. This guy is k2 dot epsilon 1, sigma 2 minus sigma 1, all the way to kn dot epsilon 1, sigma m minus sigma 1. And here I have epsilon 2 dot epsilon 1, sigma 2 minus sigma 1, all the way to epsilon n, epsilon 1, sigma m minus sigma 1. OK? So once again, I want to translate gauge invariance for linear dependency. So what do we need? We need that every time you replace the polarization vector of a particle by its corresponding momentum, the amplitude has to vanish. So imagine that we replace this vector by the corresponding momentum vector. What happens? Well, look at this column. We replace epsilon 1 by k1. So this becomes equal to this. This becomes, all these dots become equal to these dots, clearly. This one becomes equal to this, because we're replacing epsilon 1 by k1. This one doesn't quite look equal to this, and this one doesn't quite look equal to this. So in principle, you would say, well, let me put 0. Who knows? Maybe it's going to work. So you keep going. And this is equal to this. You see, epsilon 2 dot epsilon 1. But now this is k1. So it works. These ones work, and this one works. So all this column becomes identical to this column. And this matrix that I'm going to call, for the time being, psi, let me call it, it was on purpose. It's called psi. Let me call it P or F. It's called F because it's going to be our first attempt. Okay. So this matrix has the following property. It's anti-symmetric. In any case, that all that means is that this row, once we replace, this guy will become identical to this one as well, because the matrix is anti-symmetric once we make this replacement. But already, I'm happy with only one linear dependence, so this would have been fine. And that means that if we are computing something like the determinant of this matrix, every time you make the mistake of setting one of the polarization vectors to the momentum vector of a particle, you get 0. So this is 0 if any epsilon is replaced by this. But this actually seems a little too good to be true, because it's 0 for any values of the sigmas. So somehow we always shoot it. So we wanted this thing to be 0 for this, every solution of the scattering equation, for the n minus 3 factorial guys. And we now found that this is 0 for any values of the sigma. OK, maybe that's life. But so far, we have seen that everything that we do works almost right. So that we don't have room to spare. So maybe this is too good to be true. But who knows? You can just go and compute something with it. So let's put it here. And the first thing that you find is that this is a complete disaster. Why is it a complete disaster? Well, take this guy and see how many copies of polarization vector 1 you have. How can you tell how many polarization vectors 1 you have? Rescale epsilon 1 by a constant So you get all this guy rescaled by a constant and all this guy rescaled by a constant. So you get, in the determinant, you get two powers of that constant. That means that whatever we do with this formula is going to give us something that looks like this. And the same thing for epsilon 2s and epsilon 3s and so on. So we don't get a polarization vector. This looks like a polarization tensor. Isn't that terrible? Unless you were doing gravity, of course. But we're not doing gravity. We're doing Young Mills. So this is terrible. Well, I don't know if you have played with antisymmetric matrices and computed determinants of antisymmetric matrices. But if you have an antisymmetric matrix, and you compute the determinant of this guy, you can also find that in Wikipedia. You find that you do it for a four by four matrix, and magically this thing becomes something like AB minus CE plus FG square. This is for a four by four. You do it for a 6 by 6, and you also find something that depends on the entries of this thing, all square. So for any antisymmetric matrix, you compute the determinant, and you find a perfect square. Well, wouldn't that be nice? So that perfect square is something that mathematicians call the Pfaffian of the matrix M. And it's precisely the square root of the determinant. And what was the problem we had? We had two copies of everything. We had the square of the polarization vectors. What if we replace the determinant by the Pfaffian? Of course, every time the determinant vanishes, the Pfaffian also vanishes. So whatever property we had would also work nice. So at least with this replacement, we would get one copy of polarization vector 1, one copy of polarization vector 2, and so on. So this is actually looking very nice. The next thing that you do is, well, OK, fine. We avoided the immediate disaster. So let's compute this for three particles. And when you compute this for three particles, you find that it has the wrong dimension. It doesn't work to be an amplitude for Young Mills. It actually has too many powers of momenta in the numerator. It's somehow related to the other three particle amplitudes that we discussed, which I didn't tell you what theory they were. But you were supposed to ask Barbara, Lucia, or Michael, or Lionel. I don't know if you did, but in any case, that's definitely not Young Mills. So how do we fix that problem? Polarization vectors are dimensionless. The problem of momentum comes from having too many powers of momenta comes from these guys. Well, the solution, again, is a little hard to motivate, but it has to do with these mysterious things here. So let me call this C11. The matrix is antisymmetric, so it's minus C11. There is a way of choosing this so that the Pfaffian of this whole thing actually vanishes. Well, doesn't seem to be a good idea, but it sounded like a good idea at the time. So you have, let's define this guy to be minus the sum of all these terms. Actually, minus the sum of all these terms in this case. So I'm going to define this guy to be the sum of this with a minus. And the same thing for C22. It's going to be the sum of all these guys with a minus sign and so on. Now, you would be afraid that we spoiled gauge invariance by doing this, because we put this guy in here, and before everything was working because these guys were zero. Now, what happens when we replace epsilon 1 by k1? If we replace epsilon 1 by k1, C11 becomes minus the sum of k1 dot ka divided by sigma 1 minus sigma a. But what is this? Look at where? Oh, it's nowhere. Well, you will have to look in your notes. No, just look here. What happens when a is equal to 1? This is k1 dot kb, everything sum over. So you will find that this is equal to 0 thanks to the scattering equations. So this guy is going to be 0, matching this 0, only when the sigmas satisfy the scattering equation. So this is actually nice. But why did we do this? The reason we did this is that if you do this, this matrix psi has two null eigenvectors. If you hit it with this vector from 1 to n and the rest, so these guys are n-dimensional, you get 0. And if you hit it with this as well, you also get 0. And mathematicians have a nice way of defining the determinant or the Pfaffian for matrices that have less than maximal rank. And the way they do it is by saying, well, look at the null vectors, and where they can hit the matrix, you're free to remove two rows and two columns from the matrix. So you can take your matrix and remove two rows and two columns from it, from the set where the null vectors act non-trivially. So they act on the first n rows and the first n columns. So we're free to remove two guys from here. And if we remove two guys from here, we're lowering the dimension of this Pfaffian. And it turns out to be removed exactly right to match the dimensionality of the three particle amplitudes for Young Mills. But you might worry that this depends on the choice that you made, and it does. Except if you divide by a factor that depends on them, this object turns out to be independent of the choice and is called the Pfaffian prime of that matrix. And this turns out to be the integrand for Young Mills. In any dimension. Okay. So at least we made it somewhere. But now that we have this formula, it would be nice to know how to use it. And in order to use it, we have to remember how to fix this volume of this redundancy. And the way to fix this redundancy also has to do with these equations. Because if we have n equations and we use SL2C to fix three of the variables, we will find that we have n equations for only n minus three variables. And that would be a disaster. It turns out that these equations also have some linear dependence. So only n minus three of them are linearly independent. So we can integrate, we can define this whole thing as follows. The integration can be done by removing three of the sigmas and removing three of the equations. And what happens when you remove three of the sigmas in string theory? You pay a price, which is called the Fayev-Popov-Yakovian of cage fixing the SL2 redundancy, which again, I'm going to blame it on quantum field theory 3. So you have seen this, how to cage fix the SL2C redundancy. And today in the tutorial, you will see it again. And the way to do it is by putting a factor that contains the difference of the sigmas you're removing. And the way you remove the redundancy coming from the equations is exactly the same. So you're also supposed to put here a factor that compensates for the equations that you have removed. Times your integral on the left and your integral on the right. Let's see, this is the middle one. The front can go all the way up. This one can stay there. And this is the last thing we're going to do, which is to say that if you look at this formula, it somehow begs you to do something. It's telling you that you have these two integrands, one on the left and one on the right. So could it be that these objects are somewhat independent? And if you replace one by another, you could get theories that are consistent. So the question is, could I left and I right be independent units or building blocks of theories? And the answer is yes. So let's write a total integrand. So this is a total one. By putting two copies of what is the left integrand there. So we have trace PA1 and so on, sigma 1 minus sigma 2, all the way to sigma m minus sigma 1 plus permutations. And you put another copy of the same thing. Could this be a theory that somebody has studied? So what you do, or what we ended up doing most of the time, was to compute few of them and write down a Lagrangian and see if you could recognize it. So the game became not of somebody giving you a Lagrangian and you computing the scattering amplitudes, but the game became guessing some object that looks nice. You compute all these scattering amplitudes, see what they look like, and reconstruct a Lagrangian. Turns out that the Lagrangian for this thing is the Lagrangian for scalar particles. Not one of them, but many of them. And the interaction Lagrangian is something that looks like this. So it's something that has two UNs. In fact, so you could call them UN and UN tilde. And these are the structure constants of each one of them. And this is just a theory of with cubic interactions. So it's lambda with scalar theory with cubic interactions. We call this theory the bi-adjoint theory because each of these scalar fields transforms in the adjoint representation of one of the UN groups. So you have two, so you call it the bi-adjoint. Each one of these guys transforms in one adjoint representation. And last, but definitely not least, what happens if instead of double copying this guy, we double copy the right integrand of Young-Mills? So what if we put here the Pfaffian prime of psi? Times another copy of itself. So what did we say? How many polarization vectors would you get for each part? Two. This one gave you something that was multilinear in polarization vectors, and this one is giving you something that has degree two in each polarization vector, and therefore the polarization vectors can be combined after you do the calculation, they can be combined into a single polarization tensor. Now the question becomes, what could this possibly be? It's a theory of rank two polarization, a theory that has massless particles whose particles are rank two or correspond to rank two representations of the Lorentz group. And I know you were expected to say, no, it's not gravity. No, but in this case, yeah, the story just becomes Einstein gravity. Okay. So what happens after this is the natural thing that happens. You take two possible routes. You take the more foundational questions, like why are these formulas there? Why do they exist? Is there a string theory behind that computes these formulas? The answer to that question will be on Monday. Can you generalize this from tree level to loop amplitudes? So can you replace the Riemann sphere by a torus? The answer to that question will be on Tuesday. Can it be generalized to all orders in perturbation theory? The answer to that question will be, well, you have to do it because nobody actually knows. So that's an open problem. And the other route that you can take is the one that says, well, we had lots of fun guessing these integrants. Can you guess integrants that are more general, different from these ones, and produce other theories that people have seen or people haven't seen? And by now, there is a huge list of possible integrants that you can construct that correspond to many theories that people have seen. And there is at least one that I know that you can construct, which nobody seems to have seen or used any time so far. Let's see, what else? What's the status of the conjecture? Well, the status of the conjecture is that we still hope that it's actually possible to construct every possible S matrix in this form. And what I hope is that there will be a nice way of taking these objects and deforming them in order to construct the string theories out of them. Okay? And then the answer to that question, maybe, will be at the end of next week. So I won't say anything else so far.
Who's going to lecture next week?
Sorry?
Who's going to lecture next week?
Okay. Monday and Tuesday is a surprise. I won't tell you until they come. Well, it's actually, and you could find out. Should I spoil the surprise? Shit. Oh, maybe. Oh, it's tempting. It's tempting. Okay, I'll tell you. So on Monday and Tuesday, the lectures will be given by two former Psi students who have become leaders in these developments. Actually, the reason I'm not giving the lectures on Monday and Tuesday is that these two people who are coming, they know much more about what they are going to be talking about than I do. So actually, I'm going to be sitting on the other side now. So I'm going to be sitting there and taking notes as well. So so it's going to be great. And then I'll let the other ones be surprised. Okay? Very good. Thanks.